And 10, the nature of knowledge is basically their epistemological accounts. And specifically, I think what I mean, or I know what I mean, is that this concerns the possibility of our apprehending specific objects, objects that we encounter by normal experience. That pertains to both of these thinkers. A broader consideration is the knowledge of nature, which I think is largely a question I mean to attribute to Aquinas. What we know of things, how we know of things, what they are, is their nature, which is something Kant and most of his contemporaries would take exception. So the first glance, the title itself seems rather unworkable because Kant, in terms of his Copernican revolution, says that not that cognition conforms to objects, but that objects conform to cognition. And Aquinas readily holds the truth as a conformity of the intellect with the objects. So this places Aquinas in a tradition. He's not named by Kant. He's part of a tradition. I think he would lump him into that, that Kant explicitly rejects. So the contrast is clear. So the question is, well, then what's to do with this? So despite the obvious contrast between these two, and I think even along with it, there are significant, even interesting points that help highlight both of these accounts of cognition in terms of the contrast. So what I intend to do is begin with a review of Kant's account of cognition, the nature of cognition, then proceed to Aquinas, his account of cognition, and then contrast these two accounts, endorsing, as you might suspect by how I'm dressed, Aquinas's approach to this, particularly how he understands the knowledge of entities. So to begin with Kant's account of cognition, it is because of the unknowability of things in themselves that Kant proposes that we account for cognition not beginning with the object, but by the interplay of the two faculties of cognition, sensibility and understanding. Sensibility is that by which objects are given. Understanding is that by which objects are thought. Now, as we know, as anyone knows who's read the first critique, he begins with an account of sensibility in the Transcendental Aesthetic. There is an advantage of beginning, however, with the understanding. So I'm basically going to skip the aesthetic. I approach this, I will begin, most of my remarks will be restricted to the Transcendental Analytic, which proceeds from the table of judgments to the table of categories to the principles. And hopefully you have access to the first handout that diagrams that in rather overwhelming, well, not sufficient detail. As one priest once said, too much is always sufficient. So we'll approach these intricate details of this account, and there's much to be said about each of these tables. But I think that ultimately what these tables are, over and above what they are in themselves, they are the details of how they advance towards his account of cognition. He starts with the table of judgments, which is kind of at the furthest remove from our possibility of understanding, of apprehending things. So he moves sort of in a stepwise fashion towards our ability to understand or to cognize things. So also with the Transcendental Analytic, he lays out a lot of details, which I think are more helpful to us as we proceed. Now, just as a point of clarification, which I think is probably evident enough, I'm going to follow what I'll call the order of derivation in the handout. That's how we proceed from the table of judgments, the table of categories, the principles, and then how we actually apprehend things. There's the order of experience, which proceeds sort of in the other way. It starts with what I encounter. Then there's how I understand that particular intuition with respect to with a concept, and then how I might think that concept in a judgment. So to begin with the table of judgments, which I've laid out there for you. The thing we notice about this is that it's understanding in its proper domain what it does in and of itself. Even though cognition necessarily involves the interplay of understanding and sensibility, in this table we have a kind of an exhaustive catalog of the details by which understanding proceeds. This, of course, is not cognition. It's thought, it's judgments about cognition. One of the things he's proud to note at A81, B106, this means of, well, I should preface that by, He makes comments about the table of categories, which I think also I'm going to appropriate them for the table of judgments. One of the things he says at A81 is this is a kind of exhaustive presentation of the faculty of understanding, a complete and systematic modification of all the forms of judgment. By this, I think he means to advance a kind of metaphysic of human cognition, because he claims to have identified all possible modifications of the fundamental operation of judgment. So that's something to which I'll return. He also notes, after the table of categories, that these two tables divide, or maybe all three tables, divide into two headings. The first two, those of quantity and quality, he designates as the mathematical forms. The other two, relation and modality, are dynamic. Now, how we might understand this, the mathematical terms characterize judgment within itself. It characterizes how S is related to P in terms of how the subject is distributed relative to the predicate and how the copula, connects the subject and the predicate, can be modified. So that's all within a particular judgment. The dynamic descriptions of judgment, the relation and the modal categories, are relating to a judgment in terms of, with the relational, is how one judgment would stand relative to another. And then the second one, the modal, how it concerns the copula, much like the forms of the quality, but as it understands relative to what the judgment is meant to describe. So there's a slight difference in that. Another remark he makes after going through the table of categories is that the third item under each heading is understood to be a combination of the first two. This, I think, is most evident on that chart, where you see that under relation, you have categorical judgment is just S is related to P. Under the hypothetical, you have two judgments. You have two subjects and two predicates, and they're related with an if-then qualification. And then finally, the disjunctive has a sort of neat way of combining the two. You have one subject distributed over a range of predicates. So that's, in some respects, it's easy to see how the third item under any heading is a result of the other two. But I don't claim to be able to explain that in every setting, every step of the way. So what the table of judgments describes, I think, is a sort of combinatorial function of the understanding, how it combines one content with another, in this case, concepts. So we proceed, and then one thing we might notice is the first two elements under the first two headings can give us the square of opposition. So we have a universal judgment with an affirmative copula. That would be an A, a universal negative, et cetera. So this is deriving somewhat from the tradition, but he's expanding this in a much more complete way. So to proceed through this table, under the form of quantity, the first mathematical form, the first heading under the mathematical form, we have a universal, a particular, and a singular. Now, he alleges that the singular is a result of the first two, saying that it can be treated like a universal, which I think is plausible, although it's not entirely clear to me how the fullness of that remark. But where the universal distributes all of S relative to P, the singular just takes an individual S and treats it, I suppose, as something of a universal. That's under the table of under the heading of quantity. Under the heading of quality, the second mathematical form, we have the relation which concerns the qualification of the relation of the predicate and the subject and the predicate. And the third item, which is unique, which he adds to this, is what he calls an infinite. The soul, he said, and his example is the soul is not mortal. He claims that this places the soul in an unlimited domain of undying beings, which I'm not entirely clear to make of that. I think perhaps if we meant something like if we characterize this with a Venn diagram, usually there's an overlap between S and P. This seems to suggest that S would be entirely outside of P in a range of infinite extent. That may or may be persuasive to you, I'm not sure. The point of it, though, is whatever these things mean in and of themselves, more important for us is how they develop as he proceeds. Then to proceed to the dynamical forms, the first one is a relation, which I've described as a, he describes as a, first as a categorical, and then a hypothetical, which is a kind of, it's not just a combination of two judgments. It's a combination in a kind of asymmetric way by an if-then statement. As I want to say, I think part of the point of this is not what these tables are in themselves, but what they redound to in subsequent subsequent development. What I want to say is that the hypothetical under the table of categories becomes a relation to, between antecedent and consequent, and then finally, under the principles, it becomes a temporal succession or causality. So you finally add a sensible element in the third table, that of time, and that qualifies this if-then statement which began in the table of judgments. Perhaps that's plausible, I don't know. Second, or finally we have the modal, which is again how we understand the copula, which describes something either it, when the is may mean it may be, or it is actually so, or it must be. An example, I think, of the apodictic, the third heading, the third item under the modality, is the way you can say under the, you could take the disjunctive form, and you could have S is necessarily P or two, P1 or P2 or P3, such as you might say, it must be the case that it is either sunny or rainy or cloudy or snowing. You kind of distribute it in that respect. Okay, so that's how he begins with the table of judgments. Then the next table is the table of categories, which I think is one step closer to a given intuition that is mentioned throughout the critique. The table of judgment is given, it has received a given content, that of particular concepts. The table of categories, I think, is also assuming a kind of given content, but here it's an empirical intuition related to a particular concept. As he says, the same function that gives unity to the different representations in a judgment also gives unity to the mere synthesis of different representations in an intuition, which expressed generally is called the pure concepts of understanding or the categories. So here, in the table of categories, we have the same combinatorial action of the understanding. Now, not between two concepts, but between a given intuition and a concept. So I've illustrated this with the first under the heading of quantity, with the concept of dog. So it's a question of you're given a particular intuition, which you know to be a dog, itself a separate question, which I'll address momentarily. The question is, how might I think that particular intuition relative to the concept dog? I might do so as an individual, I might apply several individuals to which that concept pertains, or I might identify all the individuals under a certain ambit under the, according to that concept. So that's the first one. So there's a similar form that here. You're just qualifying the way these the individual is distributed relative to the concept. Under the heading of quality, we have reality, negation, and limitation. Now I've proposed that we might understand, first place the limitation is, the first place you have a reality, X is blue, or X is not blue, and the limitation would be some sort of middling ground between them. This doesn't necessarily pertain to logic per se, but it seems to have to do with the way that logic can be brought to bear on experience, which again, I think makes more sense as we proceed. Okay, and then, so that's the mathematical forms. The dynamical forms, we have the first one under relation. We have inherent and subsistence. This is how accidents adhere relative to a substance or qualities with respect to an object. So with the, under the table of judgments, you had the description of a categorical judgment itself, just judgment, and how it might be modified. Here you have a particular concept, or a particular entity, relative to how it's understood in its, as it's apprehended in an intuition. Then you have the antecedent and consequent, which is here described, which I'm suggesting is a kind of logical version of what we had in the hypothetical. It's more, has more content to it. So it doesn't necessarily in itself have a temporal domain. So with an antecedent and consequent, I could say, if it rains, then it will be wet. Or I might say, if it's wet, then it has rained. The logical form doesn't necessarily in itself distinguish that. You have to rely on a sensible qualification, which is time, which doesn't really show up until the principles of understanding. And then finally, modality. You have possibility or impossibility, existence or non-existence, and necessity and contingency. And these are the same forms that you have under the modality. It's just how they're applied to this relation of a given concept with its intuition. Now, all of this describes a combination, again, it's a logical operation, albeit one that's not typically described, not of one concept with another, but of one concept with an intuition. The question that arises, I think, ultimately is, how is it that we're able to describe my apprehension of a particular item, some X, described under the table of categories, and by a particular concept? This is something that he takes up in a very brief chapter called On the Schematism of the Pure Concepts of Understanding. The table of categories isn't of combination of judgment, but of concepts relative to their intuition. It presumes something more basic, namely my ability to apprehend objects by their concept. So it's a kind of bridge between sensibility and understanding, something that Kant fittingly describes as the imagination, which is an effect of the understanding on sensibility. That's at B152. It's not a new faculty. Heidegger wanted to make a claim that it is. I don't think that Kant necessarily describes it that way. It's just a new employment of the understanding, which, as we've been proceeding, the understanding has been the focus of our appreciation here, of our analysis. First in the table of judgments, then in the table of categories, and now understanding kind of applied to sensibility. So he describes this as this bridge. Specifically, he describes imagination, this is at B151, is the faculty for representing an object, even when it's not present, in intuition. He gives more specificity to this when he talks about a schema. This is at A140 and B180. A schema of a particular concept, he says, is a general procedure of the imagination, understanding directed towards the sensibility, by which we can provide a concept with its image. This, I think, is a particularly useful discussion here. His schema of particular of empirical concepts, as I'll say more about a bit, mirrors what I think Kant describes in the Phantasm, but that's more to come. So his first illustration of this is by way of an example for the mathematical concept of the number 5. So the concept is something we all naturally know what it is. He wants to say it's not just an understanding of how you use it in a sentence or its logical or grammatical use. There's an implicit understanding, sometimes explicit, the way you connect that concept with a particular intuition. The example that he provides is 5, and then he gives 5 dots on a page, 5 dots on a horizontal line. That's one expression. That's one sort of instantiation, if you want, of the mathematical concept 5. Now, there's other possibilities. You might have 5 dots in a row going vertically. You might have two horizontal lines. On the first line, you'd have 2. The second, you'd have 3. That's another possibility of it. Or you could have them as they're distributed on the face of a dice. This, as I say, is the means by which we're able to move from a concept to its instantiation. He gives another example, that of a triangle, which can be presented in a variety of ways, as an acute or equilateral or isosceles. This describes how we can pass from one to the other. And I think it's a very useful possibility. It sort of addresses the kind of dualism you have with someone like Descartes or even Locke. You have understanding and sensibility. How do we bridge the two of them? With this the schema of an empirical concept, that's a discussion of this. Now, one other example he provides is that the number 5 or a geometrical concept of a triangle, those are concepts you could say that we sort of invent in some sense. There are other things that we encounter And there he gives a the example of a dog, which, by the way, is why I included that on the table of categories under the first heading. He says a dog is the shape of a four-footed animal in general. As I'll say in a bit, that's a bit problematic, but at least it gets us sort of to the understanding of this is how cognition occurs. It's this procedure of the imagination of taking a concept and then generating a particular given appearance of it, or understanding. It's a rule. It's a way I could generate a whole host of these possibilities. Now, this describes how we pass from concepts to intuitions, how we can generate these intuitions, either of the number five or a triangular shape or a dog. Now, it's also possible, I think, and here I'm going to refer to a couple other handouts here, how we might generate a shape of a dog. So, for example, I'll ask you to put on 4C, which is just that. It's the shape of a dog. Does that come up?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So the idea would be you could generate this shape in the way he's described. My suggestion is that that's how you generate it. An experience, what you would do is you might encounter the object in a field of vision. This is at 4A. There, this is a colorblind test, and some of you might not be able to see anything from that. And the idea is that, so if you can generate this shape, when you apprehend it, what you do is you sort of outline the shape, and that's 4B. And so what you do is you apprehend the shape of the object relative to the cues that are given by sensibility. So this, I think, it's almost the clutch of his mechanisms of cognition. It's how we pass from thought about things to the actual presentation and how we apprehend that. So I think that this is what's going on here. In the original table, number one, I would put the schema between the table of categories and the table of principles. That's where ultimately he's going. So the question is then, he's identified this, I think, in rather passing manner. The question is, how ought we to understand this relative to the final stage of his development? And this is the synthetic principle. These are his synthetic principles of understanding. Now, I'm going to kind of break out of the normal procedure here. I'll start with the analogies of experience. I'm going to start with the dynamical principles first. Here, I think you have the clearest unification of these logical forms with the form of sensible intuition, namely, specifically time. So where you had persistence, where you had inherence and subsistence, when that's given a kind of temporal dimension, that has the persistence of the substance over time. The first one is maybe the inherence of the accidents in the substance, thought about in a logical sense. Now you're given a kind of temporal version of that. And that, so in that sense, I think passing from the categories of relation to the analogies of experience, you're just basically adding a temporal dimension. So that gives you the persistence and subsistence. And then, as I said before, antecedent and consequent, sort of logical relation between these things, is now given a temporal succession, that by which we can understand causality. So here he's introducing how causality is something that comes from us rather than the world. And then finally, simultaneity, where community is something you had among logical relations among concepts like husband, wife, and children. Now you're given that in maybe a spatial temporal possibility, things that exist at the same place at the same time, simultaneity. So that's how we've gotten one of those headings. I am going to pass over the postulates empirical thinking. I think they're evident enough. More important, I think, for us in this concern about how we actually apprehend things have to do with the mathematical categories and their how they're changed into the principles. So the most fundamental, I think, of which are the axioms of intuition. Now, it's one thing, it's important, or it's worth noting, that where in the categories you had three items, here you have only one. So you've had a unification of these elements. And one way we might think about this is under the heading, under the categories of quality, you have reality understood as a, you have quantity understood as a particular or a plurality or a totality. What you're doing, what you seems to be describing there is you're, that sort of action of the understanding introduced in the table of judgments is this discrete combination of discrete elements, one with the other. Now in the table of categories, you're kind of continuing that as one, two, three, etc. When you apply a temporal dimension to that, you're, that distinct operations of the understanding is now given a continuum. So the understanding is itself qualified by a spatio-temporal extent, rather than having this sort of punctified sort of elements of action. They're given a unified possibility, and that's how he says. Under the axioms, all sensory intuitions are extensive magnitudes. So what he's done here is he's accounted for extensive magnitude, the very basis of what I've described by way of the schematism. You're generating an image, or you're locating an image. That has any shape that you apprehend has to do with the combination of various extended magnitudes, the outline around the shape of it, whatever. If it's a square, you just have four of them. How you can generate those, how you can understand their generation by the interplay of sensibility and understanding. And that gives you the axioms of intuition. So that's something like draw. He says, I can't represent a line to myself without drawing it in thought. That is to say, successively generating all its parts from one point, thereby sketching this intuition. That's at A162. So it's this generation of a kind of continuum, a spatial-temporal continuum, from the distinct elements described under the categories. So we have space and time are what we generate in a way by the interplay of sensibility and understanding, where he says, I generate time in the apprehension of the intuition. This is at A143, which is another reason why I was hesitant to begin with the transcendental aesthetic. There he seemed to describe space and time as these continuous coordinates that almost have an infinite extent. And now he's described it as something, I generate time in the apprehension of an intuition. That's where the interplay of sensibility and understanding at the most basic fundamental level account for the possibility of what's described in the empirical schematism. So finally, there's the anticipations of perception. He says that in addition to the, this is at B207, in addition to the intuition of mathematicals for some object in general, through which something is existing in space or time is represented, i.e. the real of sensation as a merely subjective representation by which one can only be conscious of that the subject is affected, which one relates to an object in general. So in addition to the empirical intuition, which is secured by the axioms of anticipation, we now have perception, which includes a particular content of sensation, noting that from the empirical consciousness, which is attained in perception, to the pure consciousness, which is intuition, there's a gradual possibility is given to us, something by which we either increase or decrease the content of sensibility. So in a certain sense, what this describes, and I'll go back to my figure, so if we pass from 4C to 4B, there's a way in which we can sort of account for what I've described with that figure. On the one hand, you're just given, you might start with 4B, you're just given the manifold of sensibility, and then you're able to sort of describe the shape of it by diminishing. You get the shape by diminishing the content of sensation. So that's part of how you do this. It seems to me you could sort of start with the contents of sensation and draw it down, so to speak, to where you just get the intuition, or you can do it in the other way. You start with what you're given, and then you start with something you're given, and then you kind of supply the sensible intuition that fills in the shape of it. So what he's describing, I think, in the Anticipations of Perception, this is not an empirical transition, the way that Hume describes with his missing shade of blue, as if you sort of supply different empirical levels of that. This seems to be something that pertains to the way in which we attend to colors or other qualifications of things we perceive. Now, one question might be, why would you bother to supply this? I think because in some respects, there's a way in which when we think about the world, we tend to think about it in terms of spatially extended objects. I might say, put the smaller box on top of the bigger box, and that's all the way I refer to them. I don't bother to I don't give you all the sensory content of it, although I could if necessary. So I think there's a way in which he's supplying how we can supply or we can increase or diminish the content of sensibility by which we're able to give the shapes, which is so part and parcel of the schema of the concepts he's given. So to describe this, so to consider this, so as I said, there's the order of derivation, which I've kind of proceeded through. And then there's the order of experience. Now, in the order of derivation, there's clear steps to this. There's the table of judgments, the table of categories, the schematism, and then there's principles themselves. In the order of experience, I can say, I'm relatively confident we can talk about going from the table of categories to the table of judgment. The actual apprehension of the object itself is a very complex interplay described by the anticipations, the anticipations of perception, the axioms of intuition, and then also the schema of the concept by which those things are united. So in a certain sense, as he said at the beginning, cognition is itself the result of this interplay of understanding and sensibility. It's not just adding one to the other. By the time he's given the full extent of this, it's a rather complicated and sophisticated possibility that accounts for that by which we're able to apprehend the world. The key part, one of the key parts, which I mentioned earlier, he's very careful, of course, to avoid having anything to do with the thing in itself, which I presented on that first chart with a sharp line. There's the thing in itself, which we just don't know. All we have is the perception that's given to us of an object. So what I presented there is, so I've supplied what you might have by the schematism would give you the sort of an outline of a dog, and there's a sort of a silhouette of a dachshund. That's the best I could do on the internet. And then there's the way the anticipations would allow you to pass either towards the perception of the dachshund with all of its sort of colored markings and other details of it, or the other way. So that's basically Kant's account of cognition. Okay. That's the first part. The second part is Aquinas' account of cognition, and that has to do with the third handout I've given you. So the principal difference is that Kant's account bears on philosophical elements that are posited but never experienced, the thing in itself. So number two, I have that sharp line on the other side of the perception. Aquinas' account is not as burdened with such an imponderable element. Rather, it's an encounter with objects that can be understood in terms of our own cognitive powers. We face entities. That's one of the differences I have there. For Kant, I was always careful to refer to objects, whereas I think for Aquinas, we're talking about entities, real beings, which are possessed of their own essence or nature. So in a certain sense, where on the third chart, there's a way in which you could talk about there's the perception that Kant left us with, which is what Aquinas would have, but you could have underwritten that appearance of a dog or that particular dog is underwritten by a sort of immanent essence or nature in the thing itself, and that's ultimately what we're encountering here. So, proceeding through Kant's account, we note that there's this distinct order in each stage, with each stage enjoying its own particular domain. So I'm presuming this should be fairly familiar and perhaps not nearly as difficult as what Kant has us describe. He starts with sensation, which are just the data of experience, the proper sensibles which pertain to each sense, and then there's the common sensibles. Okay, so that's the base, the content of perception. Also, we note that there's a kind of threefold stage of this. There's sensation, which is just the content of sensibility. Then there's perception, which has to do with our apprehension of individual objects. And then there's intellection, how we can think about them. So there's a kind of overlap. There's a nice comparison between Kant and Aquinas in that. The second level is that of perception, which arrives at the apprehension of individual objects. And that proceeds from lower to higher. I think I have that on there. Right. So you have the sensation with all of its specific data, and then that's passed on to the inner senses, of which the Hida identifies four. The first is the common sense, which correlates the relevant sensible data. This would have to do with an experience, say you're sitting at lunch and you're eating pizza or something, and you're perceiving a lot of different things. The common sense, I think, is that which correlates the proper details with the proper object. So if the pizza is sitting on the plate, the common sense, I think, is what distinguishes the pizza from the plate. And there might also be sound. If you bite into the pizza and it's a thin crust, it's gonna crunch, and that's one sound. But as you do that, you might hear somebody in the room talking. So I think the common sense sort of distinguishes. It sort of parses the data that's given in sensibility according to specific objects. I think there's also a way in which it would distinguish between one set of sort of one visible sense of sight data relative to the object relative to its background or something like that. So that's the first step. Then there's the imagination, which among other things supplies a phantasm, which allows, I think, a more dynamic representation of that object. And I'm suggesting it's something like a holograph. The common sense presents something like a snapshot. It's just something that you experience in a particular moment, almost in a two-dimensional way. The phantasm allows us to sort of take that object, and it's always of a specific object, and if you want, sort of turn it around in your mind so that we can understand. If you're looking at this podium, you can't see the back of it, but you understand you could if you could sort of move around it. And I think there's a way in which the phantasm allows us to do that. It allows us to anticipate shapes in a way that we don't necessarily experience at the moment. And this is something I think we develop, part of our cognitive development. Then there's the cognitive or estimative sense, which is the capacity to I think, rearrange the world according, among other things, it's the capacity to rearrange the world according to our own designs. The example, perhaps the most helpful example that Aquinas gives of this is the way a bird builds a nest. What it does is it takes the twigs that it finds in nature and it reorders them according to its own purposes. So the common sense is a kind of snapshot. The phantasm is a holograph or almost kind of a moving representation. The cogitative or estimative sense, the animals have an estimative sense. It puts the world in a kind of order according to what the individual wants. And then finally there's memory. So that's as we apprehend a particular object. And then there's intellection, which includes simple apprehension. The entity is apprehended by way of a concept or dog. So this involves, starting at the bottom again, the agent intellect illumines and then abstracts the intelligible species or concept from the phantasm, which it then presents to the passive intellect. And in the passive intellect, Aquinas identifies four stages. There's mere potency, it's passivity, when the passive intellect is awaiting content. And then there's the intellect in habit. This seems to be something like when he describes our ability to work our way through a particular discipline, to actualize an intellectual capacity here. It's not, and of course now it's much more developed than what you have with perception. It's not just individual objects, it's thinking about things in an abstract manner. So that's intellect and habit that's in the first act. And then finally there's intellect, this actual intellect that's in second act, which is where you engage in that activity. If you, say, know how to do differential equations, you have the habit, you don't really achieve second act until you're actually affecting that. And then finally, there's intellection is the second operation of the intellect, which is judgment, which I just included here to make a contrast with what we have in Kant. Now, as I say, it's clear and it's sort of reassuring that there are these distinct stages of cognition, sensation, and then perception, and then intellection. One problem I think that presents itself, and I'm thinking that Kant sort of alerts us to this in a way, is that we need to be careful about taking these as a kind of mechanisms of cognition, which is a phrase that some authors use about when describing what Aquinas is doing. And the way it is that it's suggested as a kind of conveyor belt. Sensibility takes in the content, perception reworks it into objects that are perceived and understood in a kind of more sophisticated way, and the intellection itself gives way to an entirely different manner of apprehending these things. And the problem is, as I think some of the early modern critics of this approach would say, is that among other things, you're making these rather remarkable jumps when you go from sensation to perception, for example. Sensation, you just have data. With perception, particularly with the phantasm, you don't just have data, you have an object. And you have an object as representable in ways that you don't necessarily encounter it right now. So the question is, how are we able to do this? Somehow it's almost like this miraculous event has occurred that allows us to do this. And then when we pass from perception to intellection, from the phantasm to intelligible species, we have an abstract representation which pertains to innumerable elements, individuals which we don't actually encounter. How is this possible? There's also perhaps a way in which reading this as kind of just the mechanisms of cognition, a kind of self-contained cognitive series of events, it almost risks a kind of solipsism that this is all self-contained and all we needed to do is supply the data and the machine sort of cranks up according to its own possibilities. So to avoid this, as some authors have pointed out, we ought to include in a kind of positive terms the role played by the entity's essence or nature. We have to make sure we include that in a way that redounds, that sort of accounts for these, quote, jumps that occur in cognition. So it's more than just a question of registering sensory data or even apprehending that data in relation to an entity. Ultimately, this elicits from us a kind of response as we try to understand the entity's nature. One example of this would be in the way, say, a fox is in the desert or in the woods and it hears a noise. So that's just the sensory data. First, it will try to understand, if you want, the nature of that noise. Is it something that just happens, say, from the wind? Or is it something that happened from a plant falling down? Or maybe it's another animal? So there's a way in which it's striving to understand, trying to get at the essence, the nature of the thing that caused that event. Then if it ascertains that it's another animal, it will go further. Is it something that's smaller, say as a chipmunk, in which case it might be prey for it, or is it something that's larger, say maybe something like a bear, in which case it's a predator and it'll want to flee from that. So there's a way in which, what I'm getting at, there's a way in which even in a preconceptual manner, in a way that's written into nature itself, nature or the things of sensory, perceptual apprehension of things seeks to arrive at the nature of these things. The fox will want to know what it is that's out there and how, and it will respond accordingly. It will do so according, and I think this, of course, this is implicit. It doesn't have a conceptual understanding of this, but there's a way in which it does respond to things that are given to it. That's, and then more significant, of course, is the cognitive involvement that comes with human cognition. Ultimately, the objects of our understanding, Aquinas says, following Aristotle, is the essence or nature of the things that we encounter. We desire, we strive to understand what things are in themselves, and we do so according to our own lights. Now, and we do so in a way that's different from, say, what animals do. I'm suggesting there's a kind of analogous way in which an animal, such as a fox, would want to ascertain the nature of something that it hears in the distance. It would do that for its own benefit, and that would have to do with its own estimate of sense, how it is disposed, either positively or negatively or possibly indifferently, to things that are outside of it. Humans do so in that way, but also what we strive to do is we seek to understand the nature of things in themselves, and that's part of how we're able to account for this, the description of the Thomistic account of empirical cognition, is that we understand that there is an entity with an inherent nature or essence in it, And what we're striving to do in our cognitive engagements is to understand through our own lights, not just what's given to us, but that from which it is given. So there's a way in which all of this happens, and I think that has to do with the way in which we engage, not just with sensory content, not just the matter of our experience in the way Kant wants to describe, but we encounter something that's outside of that. So ideally, this would have to do with the way in which we encounter things. So here, I would add in another possibility. What we might amend, this handout number 3, instead of putting a picture of a dog, I might, and this is what I would ask for 5A, which you have an actual dog, or, well, not an actual dog, it's a photograph of one, but you have to do what you, the best you can do. So the point is, it's not just a shape, it's an entity, and there's a way in which it elicits a kind of response to us, and we seek to know what it is, and it's not just the shape of it, although that's part of it. There's the way it's situated in nature, it's the way it's oriented towards us. And that dog is kind of looking at us with almost a kind of expectant look. I could have given you another picture. I could have given you, say, an angry pit bull or something. That would elicit a different kind of response on our behalf. And then there's also an indication of a very different nature. So the claim is that there are natures underneath what we actually perceive, and that's the aim of our cognitive engagements. Now, a cynic to this would object to the whole idea of there being a nature. Someone like Francis Bacon would say that natures are just something that we make up or we inject into nature. The mastery of nature to the relief of man's estate, a phrase of his, is a question of our identifying or sort of working into, quote, nature, and we working according to our own possibilities. So Francis Bacon or one of his supporters might suppose something like, when you say dachshunds have a nature, you must, and you say something like, well, they're hunters. Maybe that's what you mean with 5B. You just mean this thing that's what you present. Now, the point of this dig, I think, is to say that you're presenting it as a hunter, and that's what you're suggesting. But in fact, you might tell me that maybe by nature they hunt small animals, but the fact of the matter is nobody uses them for that, or very, very few people use dachshunds for that end. This is an idea that what you called nature, something what's endemic to itself, is just has to do with the way we use it. They're not really hunters unless you want to dress them up like that. Or there's a way in which you might also change them and other silly things that which would people do who own dachshunds, like 5C. And then you're just doing this. They're just something that you impose on these animals. Now, as a way of a response to that, we might note that these dachshunds, in some respects, this is part of their nature. They sit still for this kind of thing in a way that other animals don't. You couldn't do this with cats, you couldn't do this with fish or birds, you couldn't do this with other kind of canines, you couldn't do this with a fox or a wolf. I'm not even sure you'd want to do it with a Rottweiler or a Doberman. So there's a way in which it does have a nature, and our approaching it, our apprehending it and interacting with it is a kind of negotiation of its nature and what that nature allows. So it's not something we're just injecting into the entity itself. And then there are other aspects of animals, such as for 5D. They do have a nature. Dachshunds have a particular nature which distinguishes them from other animals. They will overeat if you let them do that, to the point where they become something like that, or perhaps their feet don't even work anymore because they're so big for that. So the point is, we encounter these sorts of things according to their nature, which is something that is in the thing itself. We might adjust it, but we only adjust it to the extent that their nature and our nature allows. It's a kind of symbiotic interrelation there. Now, just by way of rejoinder to my reading of the advantages of Aquinas' account, one might note a kind of passing remark he makes in his commentary on the Creed, where he says that the manner of our knowing is so weak that no philosopher could perfectly investigate the nature even of a fly, which suggests a kind of damning possibility to the thing I've been proposing here, is that we don't know the essences that we are given to pursue, that we naturally investigate. The response to this, I think, is what Kant has in mind when he says we don't know, is we don't know perfectly. We don't have a kind of comprehensive knowledge of the essences of things. We don't have, in phrases that I think Kant even allow, a God's eye perspective into these things. But that doesn't mean we don't know them at all. There's a way in which we do know them. Anybody who's had any experience knows what a dog is, maybe some better than others, but we know it. It's not Locke's je ne sais quoi. It's something I know. I know at least of it. If I don't know it comprehensively, at least I know of it. As Aquinas describes in his 20th lecture on the second book of the Posterior Analytics, he describes how a kind of flood of soldiers is repeating from an advancing enemy. And there's just this chaos of soldiers running in the opposite direction. And he describes how one might make a stand, and then a second, and till a third, and until to the point where you have a kind of battle formation gradually forming there. The analogy is something the way that we understand things. Concepts arise in our minds by gradual accumulation of related individuals. So he says, by Socrates and then Plato, I start to form a concept of man, which includes sort of things like rationality or sociability. Those things gradually emerge in my mind. So no, it's true, we don't have an exhaustive understanding of the natures of things. What we have is something that gradually grows in our understanding because of our experience of them. So as a rough, this is too rough of a comparison, but I'll end with this. Kant's approach to cognition in some respects almost suggests something like our encounter with the famous duck-rabbit diagram. The agent has to understand by which concept, or maybe chooses by which concept, to apprehend the appearance. And I think this might redound to sort of moral questions. We bring our concepts to the situation and then construe it accordingly. Kant's approach, by contrast, seems to occur along the lines of an encounter with a dynamic entity, one that is possessed of its own nature, something of which we will never have a comprehensive knowledge, which is true enough, but it's still familiar to us, and it is that by which we approach by further engagements, not by dictating to nature, but allowing nature to speak for herself. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Father Brian. We have time for a few questions. Our first question comes from Zoom, Thomas Chiavati from Cornell. Thomas, please go ahead. Thomas?
Volume? No. I think his mic is off.
Can I be heard now?
Okay.
There we go.
Thank you. Thank you, Father. I want to ask about the first diagram, something on the first diagram, the table of judgments.
Okay.
The division of judgments, so the division of the base and their quality, which to my understanding that the principle of that division is the role of the copula, at least classically. So S is P, S, right. No, P is composed with S, S is not P, P is divided from S. So I'm puzzled when I see infinite with S is non-P, because I would like to take non-P as a kind of predicate, even if it's a contradictory predicate. So what's the basis in Kant's division? Why does he have this third category?
I am not entirely sure, because as you're by your understanding, you would have the infinite be S is not P. Is that right?
I would have S is non-P to be an affirmative, where non-P is simply a contradictory predicate.
Right. So you'd rather have that written as S is not P?
No. That would actually not be the same thing, right?
Yeah.
S is non-P is different from S is not P.
Right.
Because,
Right. And as I say, I am not entirely clear what he means by that. But more importantly, I think is ultimately how that redounds under the anticipations of perception, which involves a kind of diminishment of a given quantity to its extinction, or towards any particular given quantity or level of intensity to its diminution until it's zero. And that's ultimately it's the ultimate value of this. Now, what the table of the qualitative judgments under the quality judgments under the table of judgments, I'm not completely clear what that is. So I'm sorry.
All right. Our next question comes from Zach Waters from Yale.
Right.
Zach, Please go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, thank you again, Father. So I think you touched on this towards the end when you were saying especially that there are natures under our experience in contradiction to...
And present within, yeah.
So I'm thinking that something like modern cognitive linguistic theory sounds more kind of like Bacon or like Kant.
Okay.
That says that the language we use in some sense constructs our experience.
Right.
So I wonder whether you could maybe just expound on some more of your how you would give a Thomistic critique to something
like
that.
Yeah. I mean, well, I guess it would depend on the example of how we're constructing experience, but I mean, maybe there's ways you can adjust terms, how you refer to a dog as maybe as a canine versus an animal versus a domestic animal, et cetera. So there's that kind of adjustment. But I think ultimately what they would say or insist on is that there's still something to which you're referring, and that sort of limits the way you can refer to it. It can't just be something you sort of invent for yourself.
All right, our next question comes from Kayla Barsh from Yale undergraduate. Kayla, please go ahead.
Great, thank you. So my question is on the difference between Kant's understanding of a thing in itself and Aquinas's understanding of like essence or nature of the object. And I'm still trying to understand how they're ultimately different if we can't ever fully perceive like the nature of the thing when we encounter it, or you know, perhaps we can over time. But yeah, I think any clarification on that would be really helpful.
All right, no, thank you. Well, the idea there is, as I say, so for Aquinas, we understand what the essence of something is. I mean, you have some sense of what a dog is. Now, maybe if you've only seen one, you wouldn't necessarily know what they eat, but you still know what they are. And then maybe once you know what they eat, there's ways in which, you know, they can overeat. There's things which they ought not to eat, like chocolate, for example. I mean, those are all parts of what their essence or nature is, but you don't have a God's eye knowledge of everything there is to it. And I think for Kant, his thing in itself is something that would be fully independent of our cognitive powers, and therefore, by definition, is not something we can access in any sense of it. So for Aquinas, I think it's a question of, it's a lack of comprehensive knowledge, but that doesn't mean there's a complete ignorance on our part. There are still things of which we know, and things of which we know relatively well and which we can improve on. So it's not as if my initial knowledge, my rudimentary knowledge of some thing's essence is blind. It overlaps something of the essence of the nature. It doesn't do so exhaustively, but it still covers it in such a way that I can distinguish it one thing from another. And that's part of how we can say what a human being is. Human beings are rational animals. That's how we distinguish them from other animals. Now, does that mean we know exhaustively all that can be said of human rationality? Well, given the kind of ongoing finding, say, of even cognitive psychology, there's ways in which we know things now we didn't know before about the way humans know things. So it's not... it's never going to be definitive, but it's still enough that whereby we can recognize and react to in a kind of coherent way.
All right, I think we have time for one more question. This will be also from Zoom, Anthony Hayduck. Anthony, please go ahead.
So this is, I think, to continue in the same strain as Zach's question, but I guess, rather than necessarily the sort of cognitive linguistic perspective, I want to come at it from sort of the, I suppose, just general perspective of cognitive science, where we have very, I think, real gaps, which are at least in some sense supposed to be empirically provable between what at least is perceived by, say, technology apprehending an object and the human being apprehending an object. For example, in linguistics, you can tell and analyze a sound wave and tell exactly what the peaks and valleys and so forth are and what exactly that means. But if you have two different language speakers, the common example is one English speaker and one Japanese speaker, they will in fact hear different sounds in the same sound wave based on sort of what they're used to expect in sort of the linguistic apparatus which they already have. And it's the same thing, I believe, with certain visual patterns. If you're used to seeing a visual pattern, Right. Then you'll apprehend that visual pattern and so on and so forth. So I'm wondering how this would affect sort of the relationship between the phantasm, as it's supposed to, you know, provide to us some perception of an entity, and then the nature of the entity itself. Because it seems that if we actually have these situations where there is, in fact, a marked difference in groups of people into what they're actually perceiving, which has nothing to do with the nature of the entity or even the just sort of physical characteristics of the entity, but rather the cognitive apparatus, why we should sort of favor this idea that we're in some sense actually apprehending what is there rather than just sort of being presented with a very complex but nonetheless created sort of cognitive state, and how sort of a Thomistic perspective would answer that.
Okay. Well, one thing that occurs to me is that with a with somebody that speaks something, and one person who knows the language understands what the speaker meant, whereas someone who doesn't know the language is ignorant of that. So there's a way in which there's an essence there that the speaker has, that the non-native speaker at the same time would still understand something. They'll understand that this is a rational remark. They might understand that perhaps it's a question. So they understand something of it. They don't understand the meaning of it, because that's what the speaker gives. So there's a way in which that obtains as well. I mean, there's a way in which we do know something of it. Part of the question, I think, is that Aquinas is presuming a kind of our engagements with the things of nature, which I'm guessing we're going to, well, I guess that's the question, is do we accept that these are naturally sort of, do these obtain across the board? Does somebody in one culture understand what a dog is in the same way that another does? And I think in the state of, you know, in the way of natural encounter, I think we would. Now, there might be cultural differences, which of course are, in some respects, I think, added onto the natural sort of coherency that's present there. And maybe that's another thing that's added, but I think he'd still want to say that underlying that, there's still something that we interact with that tells us about what that thing is, and also in a certain sense, who we are.